Chaos. Chaos everywhere. So it's just for fun. It's J.D. Vance, 7 straight years with the Bilderbergers. Oh, my. And he worked for a billionaire or whatever the hell he is, super Zionist Jewish Peter Thiel. You don't need to know any more. That's it. Now, they're going to say nice things because it's a truncated political campaign season. And I do mean truncated. 130 days about until the selection. And it's already a done deal. They're going to have more things so that they could pull Biden out and shake everything up and put Big Mike Obama in there. They could do all kinds of things to keep people upset, confused. And had that assassination worked out yesterday, the country would today be in probably great civil unrest and rioting and shootings and all kinds of things. They would have had, right now, ready to go, false flag ops all over the place. But it didn't work. So they planned for both sides of the tracks, and I think that that's how they would be expected to. If you think that they're getting excellent consultation and advice from AI, they don't even need much help. All right. Are you there, young lady?
I am here.
Good. Here was 110 humidity today and 203 temperature Fahrenheit. Is that right?
Is that Venus?
It was in New England.
Yeah, it was. It was hot, but you know, not like there. But we've got the humidity here.
No, you can have the humidity.
No, it's awful.
And
awful.
Pink cat tongues everywhere, right?
If you're a cat, you're not happy.
I had a big hawk land on the balcony yesterday on the railing, and he was hot. He was holding his wings out and opening his mouth, and it was hot. Not a lot of fun.
I can't imagine. It must feel like an oven.
Yeah, it was. Anything you're pulling off the net about this Trump escapade that we need to hear about?
Oh, just more strife and division. I mean, people have their opinions about what actually happened and what's behind it. The left seems conspicuously quiet, though. I was surprised. There was no that I could see from those that I know. They weren't terribly mouthy.
Right. There were a couple of comments early on. Can't they get anybody that can shoot? You know, that kind of stuff from the left, which you'd expect some of the mouths that roared to do that kind of thing. Anyway, just know that as grim as it is, it's all planned. They know what they're doing. They're not going to leave anything to chance. They just don't. It's just the way the game is played. What else here? I guess that's it. We have a new video. I'm going to get into this a little early. Funeral embalmers and directors. And new evidence, this is new, on white clots, amyloid white clots, apparently. We'll find out what they say, presented in this video. So this has Richie Hirschman, John O'Looney, I can't remember the other two here, and then there's the primary guest is from Nova Scotia, and his name is Tony, L-O-H-N-E-S. Tony Lones? L-O-H, Lons?
Yeah, this is his podcast, and he's pulled together these four other individuals that are in the funeral business. John O'Looney, Richard Hirschman, a new one from Australia, Deborah George, and a surprise guest. I don't think he's in the funeral business. However, he happens to be a polymer chemist, and he has taken a stab at analyzing these clots. And
about time.
Actually, I mean, somebody with some qualifications that's actually really putting some effort into this. And he's got a lot of interesting things to say. I think we're finally getting somewhere with this. His name is Greg Harrison, and I believe he's Australian, and he's been working with labs in Hungary and New Zealand independently to see if they can reproduce the same results. And these go back to, we have to give credit to Mike Adams, who was the first to make an attempt to analyze these things, and they are shockingly consistent.
All right. This will be very interesting. I'm looking forward to this. Okay, are we ready?
Ready.
Here we go.
And I thought, Tony, you might be interested in some of the findings of what we're actually seeing, what these strange clots are. And
that's Richard Hirschman talking.
He is probably one of the better people to describe his findings and his analysis. He is a polymer chemist. Isn't that right, Greg?
That's correct, Richard. Thank you. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
I'm good.
Okay. Yeah, look, my background's 30 years in polymer chemistry. I have specialized in a lot of the analysis techniques that were being employed now on the white clots. And about 3 years ago, there was one piece of analysis that I came across just by accident, which was a thing called an ICP analysis, which is an analysis that determines the elements present in white clots. It was done by a gentleman in the USA called Mike Adams, who presented the findings of his initial white clot analysis from samples that Richard had provided him almost three years ago now. And it surprised me what the findings were, because I have used the ICP analysis. It's called inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. Don't worry about the name. It's just a very well-known piece of analytical equipment that you can rely upon to tell you what elements are there in the white clot and in what abundance. And what surprised me was in the analysis that Mike presented was the highest element they found was phosphorus, followed by sodium, tin, and later on sulfur and carbon. And we also found that there were no normal blood marker elements present in the white clots.
No normal blood elements present in the white, what we call amyloid clots. Very interesting. Okay, we knew this is not a big surprise, but it's interesting to have confirmation. Now, that means that heparin won't work on these white clots. No blood thinner will work on them because they're not composed of blood products. They're not blood clots. They're clots, but there's something else. Now, he mentioned sulfur. He mentioned several things. They're mineral-like. Thanks.
Phosphorus was the most, then sodium, which is, mm-hmm. Not unexpected, and then tin, sulfur, and carbon.
Tin, that's kind of off the wall.
Yeah, he's going to talk about that.
Very good. All right, this is very interesting already. Here we go.
Myself and an associate in New Zealand, who has been instrumental in getting the analysis done here, we've actually employed two laboratories, one in New Zealand and one in Hungary in Europe. And there's a long reason behind that, because I'm associated with people in Europe who do this kind of work. Anyway, we sent clot samples to the New Zealanders and Hungary, and they all ran ICP analyses. They found exactly the same results that Mike Adams found. We found aberrantly high levels of phosphorus. We found aberrantly high levels of sulfur, tin, sodium, and carbon. And being an organic chemist, I know a little bit about tin chemistry, because I used to sell tin catalysts, believe it or not, for polymerization reactions. So I had to study the chemistry of tin. And I wondered why tin would be present in a white clot. So obviously we could not believe this first series of results. We set about replicating the results in two separate labs. And these are, by the way, universities. I won't name them because we've got to keep that quiet at the moment. Mm. But there were two universities who did this work for us. they came back and said, you're right, there's high levels of phosphorus, tin, sulfur and carbon. So the next thing we did was to do an analysis called HPLC, High Performance Liquid Chromatography. And what this does, it actually pulls apart the white clots and tells you what the protein components are. And surprisingly, we found that the highest level of proteins we found was fibrinogen. But the HPLC analysis actually will determine what kinds of fibrinogen chains are there. And in a normal red blood clot, there's normally 1:1:1 ratio of the alpha chain, beta chain, and gamma chain. We found in our white clots that the beta chain far exceeded the alpha chain and the gamma chain. And in fact, it was beta, gamma, alpha. So the alpha was the lowest proportion. Now, we're not biochemists and we're not medically qualified in any way, but we can do simple research to find out why the fibrinogen content was so high. Fibrinogen forms fibrils. This is exactly why when John O'Learney first described the white clots as being calamari-like, he is exactly correct. That's exactly the texture that fibrin will bring into a white clot. Okay? So from then on, we then ran some amino analysis results. We actually sent samples of the white clots again to Hungary, and my colleagues ran an amino acid analysis, and they found a high level of proline, aspartic acid, lysine, and a whole range of about 18 amino acids, all that have a phosphorus affinity. And as we said, in the white clot, the element that has the highest concentration that we could confirm is phosphorus. If you take time then to research the aberrant pathways that what they call excess phosphorylation will cause, it causes a whole range of problems in the human body. So we have determined, we think, the pathway to the formation of these white clots. We have three separate pieces of analysis, all confirming our findings. And yes, you may laugh at this, but we are also employing AI, artificial intelligence, to go down the path of actually what the pathways are.
You're not going to be able to do any real research anymore without using AI because of its speed of light, ability to produce data for you, to help you along. I'm not surprised at that. Okay, let's stop right there for a moment. The white clots, the calamari clots, the COVID bioweapon clots, which are killing people all over the place and can grow anywhere in the body, are usually thought, and we've always said this, to be triggered by spike protein activity. Triggered. Does he get to the point where he looks for protein content in these clots? And we'll get there, but I'm just curious, because he hasn't mentioned spike at all yet.
He's speaking about the amino acid profile of the clots right now, and he said there's a high content of proline, and when you think about proline, you think connective tissue. But then the other amino acids that he listed have a strong affinity for phosphorus. Why is that important? Because hyperphosphorylation of various proteins is often associated with degenerative conditions.
Uh-huh.
As in Alzheimer's, we have hyperphosphorylation of the tau protein. That's a hallmark signature of Alzheimer's. So when you have proteins that are phosphorylated and they're not supposed to be, that's disease.
Okay. I'm thinking back on our program last week where we discussed and had testimonial about turbo cancer clots, turbo cancer tumors and masses having been finally analyzed and having been found to be full of spiked cells.
Oh, well,
remember
yeah.
That?
if people watch this entire interview, they get into the cancer thing, and evidently the people or some of these diagnoses of lung cancer is not actually a traditional lung cancer. It's well, like what Dr. Mackus was describing. Just it's not cancer, traditional cancer. No. It's some kind of amyloid growth.
Spike is doing it. How creepy. How really creepy. This just changes so much about health and medicine right now. It's all
well, I keep going back to what, you know, Dr. Russell Blaylock had said, what, 3 years ago now? I mean, we're going to be seeing diseases for which we don't even have a name for.
Yeah. I think he said that actually also in his last visit here before he got sick.
Yeah.
He knew what was coming. He knew. Well, these right here are descriptors that are unprecedented. They're brand new. What are you saying? All right, here we go.
The reason we have to use AI is that, as I said, we're not biochemists and we're not medically qualified. But if you ask the particular AI engine that we are using, and we are using two of them, we cross-check between one to the other. Make sure that what they tell us is correct. And yes, AI makes mistakes, and I've been able to pick up a number of those mistakes. But if you use them sequentially together, you can determine very much the biochemistry pathways. So we've now pieced together the formation of the white clots, and I'll come back to the very beginning. When we administer the injections, there is a lipid nanoparticle carrier. It's called a phospholipid. We found by our analysis that when the phospholipid releases the mRNA core of the lipid nanoparticle, at that very moment that it releases the core, it actually exposes a phosphorus head of the phosphorus lipid. The phosphorus lipid reacts with, in the bloodstream, naturally formed fibrinogen. And that's what's nucleating the white clot formation.
Okay, you're not going to be tested on this, so don't worry. But the idea of fibrinogen, we've talked about in the past, that somehow the fibrinogen goes kind of crazy and begins to build these blocking formations or clots. You were talking about this a couple of years ago. That's not a surprise. The phosphorus aspect of it, though, seems to be the big new wrinkle. Is that right?
It seems to be. They've identified at least something that can initiate, or as he was saying, nucleate, like a seedling, to start the process. I'm wondering, though, didn't the vascular surgeon that was interviewed a couple months ago on Philip McMillan's site, didn't he say that they were seeing these white clots in people who had received the J&J and AstraZeneca
and
as well?
AstraZeneca, yes.
Now, they don't use lipid nanoparticles.
He named
those
two
vaccines
specifically.
I thought that this was across the board and you know, all of the gene transfection platforms, not exclusive to the lipid nanoparticle.
So what does that tell us about if the AZ and J&J did not use LNPs, what does that tell us about
LNPs? I would say that the, you know, there's less weight to this phosphorus theory. I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, everything's on the table right now.
You bet.
You know, we've got to look at all of it. But I think I heard them say that yes, these are present in those that receive J&J and AZ as well.
That's correct. He did. All right, let's go back here and see what's next.
We can prove all this. We've actually got over 200 peer-reviewed papers confirming the pathway that I'm describing. And more importantly, once that initiation of the DSPC, now the actual phospholipid that is encapsulating lipid nanoparticle is a phospholipid called DSP6. I won't go into the name of it, but what it means is that that particular phospholipid, we found, again through the research, that it will liberate 80 to 90% of raw phosphorus heads as it releases the mRNA core. Those phosphorus heads all react with the fibrinogen in the bloodstream and they cause sandy blood. The reason you guys are seeing sandy blood and coffee grounds is that's the nucleation pathway to the final white clot formation. The other factor we found and proved, the spike protein bonds to the phosphorylated fibrinogen.
All right, we're going to have to try and make this accessible, easier, what he's saying. Can you? That's hard because this is a little bit complex.
Well, okay, so the fibrinogen is a substance that the body releases it's an acute phase reactant, meaning that there's inflammation or injury, and so the body is releasing fibrinogen to begin the repair process.
Mm-hmm. It's like sending a fire department. In other words,
right.
It's a problem. Okay.
So if you have too much of it, though, or if there's something in the blood that's causing it to behave, you know, in an abnormal way to mm-hmm. misfold or aggregate, then you've got a problem.
Okay. All right. So what do we have so far in listening to this that is helpful to us to explain amyloid clots? Is there something different here? Go ahead.
Well, we have maybe a mechanism as to how they're forming. And in this case, the theory is that it's the phosphorus in the phospholipids in the lipid nanoparticles that are creating the seeds to cause this to happen, mm-hmm. to attract the fibrinogen and start the whole process.
Okay. Does this push us down the road any closer to working on a way to dissolve these kinds of clots? Is there something in this research that would point us in a direction that hasn't been used heretofore?
Well, let's hear what he has to say. Obviously, it's the fact that these proteins are aggregated now gives them less surface area for things to work on them.
Okay.
But there may be things about them that you can exploit to, cause them to break apart.
Right, that's my question. All right, let's see what he says here. Hold on.
So when the body is generating methylcytidine generated spike, that spike in the bloodstream then starts to coagulate with the phosphorylated fibrinogen, and that feeds what we call a monomeric reaction that continues to grow. Those particles are free-flowing in the blood, and they find an anchor point. The anchor points they find are, in fact, the damaged endothelial layers. When an endothelial layer of the vascular system is damaged via inflammation and the cytokine storm that the spike protein generates, that opens up the natural phospholipid layer of the endothelial layer, and that forms anchor points for these nuclei. From these anchor points, that's when the clots begin to grow.
It's interesting.
All right, I'm going to play that again because he gets into it. All right, here we go.
The other factor causes sandy blood. The reason you guys are seeing sandy blood and coffee grounds is that's the nucleation pathway to the final white clot formation. The other factor we found and proved, the spike protein bonds to the phosphorylated fibrinogen. So when the body is generating methylcytidine...
So rather than going looking for the ACE2, et cetera, and other things, it's going to bond to this element or aggregation that he's talking about. The spike is going to bond to that and begin this process. So that's what the spike is looking to dock onto. That's my take on what he's saying.
That seems to be it.
All right. You want me to go back just a little bit? Hear that again. All right.
those phosphorus heads all react with the fibrinogen in the bloodstream and they cause sandy blood. The reason you guys are seeing sandy blood and coffee grounds is that's the nucleation pathway to the final white clot formation. The other factor we found and proved, the spike protein bonds to the phosphorylated fibrinogen. So when the body is generating methylcytidine generated spike, that spike in the bloodstream then starts to coagulate with the phosphorylated fibrinogen, and that feeds what we call a monomeric reaction that continues to grow. Those particles are free-flowing in the blood, and they find an anchor point. The anchor points they find are, in fact, the damaged endothelial layers. When an endothelial layer of the vascular system is damaged via inflammation and the cytokine storm that the...
And the endothelial layer is the interior wall of veins and arteries, most commonly. That's where you're going to find it. Right there.
Spike protein generates. That opens up the natural phospholipid layer of the endothelial layer, and that forms anchor points for these nuclei. From these anchor points, that's when the clots begin to grow.
Nuclei, how does the spike fit into these anchor points? Or does it ignore that and link on, grab on, attach itself to something else?
Well, that's a good question.
All right. Here we go.
So I'm trying to encapsulate this in a very simple term. It's quite a complex
term. It's very, Greg, can I ask a question?
Sure.
It's interesting. I mean, that was very technical. For us, well, for me as a layman, I have actually had someone mention to me about sandy blood. I've forgotten about that. But so what happens with those anchor points? I mean, some people can have 4 or 5 injections and they don't seem to have anything wrong with them, whereas some people can have, you know, massive reactions and sudden deaths in other forms, not necessarily the blood clots. So is it just a case of individual people... these things are anchored in different parts of the body, which create a different problem that leads to death. And some people seem to have had 5 injections and don't seem bothered by them at all.
Yeah.
Is there any reason, why there's a difference in people?
Okay, I'll try and answer your question in 3 parts, because it's important to understand that there is a threshold. We've actually calculated that 2 initial injections plus a 3rd booster is essentially the threshold where you get the concentration of the lipid nanoparticles. Because remember, each time you get a booster, you are still adding more of the phospholipid back into the bloodstream. Each time the booster enters the bloodstream, it releases the core mechanism, also the core methylcytidine, which generates the spike protein from each particle. We did a calculation using AI to work out that in 1 injection, there are 1.5 billion billion, not trillion, 1.5 billion billion nanoparticles, of which 80% release their phosphorus content into the blood. So it's a phosphorus hit each time you inject an mRNA vaccination.
And each one of those billion, billion particles is being sought by Spike to dock onto. That's what I think he's saying. So there's an endless ability for the Spike to generate clot formation. And he's explaining how it's happening. I think that's what he's doing.
Well, it's a theory.
It is. It is. All right. I think that's probably about enough. No, dear friends, you won't be tested on this. It's just a little idea to let you know that there are people doing some really good work on this side of the ledger trying to figure this mechanism out. Because whoever put these shots and the virus together I don't think we're all necessarily human, but they are utterly inhuman in their compatibility with life and living. It doesn't work. They're just not inimical to life. That's the spike. So I think he's talking about a billion in this case, and these are items that the spike is looking for and will dock onto and begin to aggregate these clot formations. And that means everywhere. They're everywhere. There's no restraint on it. It's completely turned loose.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory. I don't know if I can put a total stock into it just yet. I think we need to determine whether those other vaccines, injections, the J&J and the AstraZeneca, are doing the same thing, in which case that needs to be reevaluated.
Right. Got an email.
It's less likely that it's a lipid nanoparticle. And you know, just having high phosphorus in the blood, I just, you know, there's pathways that we know cause or can induce hyperphosphorylation. And one of them is oxidized thiols, thiols being sulfur residues on cells. When you have an abundance of thiol residues on cells, that is a pathway to hyperphosphorylation. And we know that these injections and the spike and the metals that are involved cause horrendous oxidative stress, which is, you know, why these thiols, these sulfur residues on your cells, would be oxidized and then can precipitate or induce this hyperphosphorylation, which is a disease state. You're going to have protein misfolding and, you know, bad signaling. But, yeah, you have to give them a lot of credit because, I mean, this is a good start. You have to start with something.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a long way to go, but that is
yeah,
a good
and
start.
I at this stage, 3, 4, you know, if you want to go back to when they originally tested this back in, what was it, 2016, when they used the U.S. military to test this thing, and maybe other unsuspecting people, I'm sure they know what these clots are composed of and why they're forming and probably how to break them down.
You betcha. Yeah, I agree. All right. We have another video here, a short one, with Naomi Wolf. You want to set that up? How much of it do you want to play? It's only 2 minutes long.
That's a very, very short clip. A study came out. It was a very small study. I don't know, a couple weeks ago maybe, about these issues that are happening with women's menstrual cycles, and this was published in Nature, so take it with a grain of salt. And so they revealed that in the I believe it was just 5 women that they sampled that were having these issues. They found that there certain cells in their ovaries were being damaged by the vaccine. Well, no surprise there. And I would think that's a no-brainer, but is that all there is to the story as to why women are experiencing these issues? I don't think so. I think that there is a lot more to the story than that. I think the hypothalamus is involved. I think dysregulation of copper and iron is involved. And, you know, maybe the signaling protein, kisspeptin, and an overload of copper in the pituitary can cause, you know, an aberrant release of hormones, reproductive hormones. So I think they're oversimplifying it, but they're just placating the public by publishing this study that, you know, leads people to think they're actually looking at it.
Okay. All right. All right, let's play this real quick here. Here we go. I think I got it. This is Naomi Wolf and Sonia Elijah.
Was to investigate the effects of the Pfizer-BioNTech mRNA vaccine on these granulosa cells and their influence on menstrual patterns. So that was their objective. So what is really startling is that they made a few observations. Firstly, they realized that the vaccine didn't have an effect on the vitality of the cells. So there wasn't sort of like a toxic effect, but what it did affect was the activity of those cells. Mm-hmm. So they did these, so this is in vitro. These human granulosa cells extracted. They looked at it, this in vitro. They exposed it to the Pfizer vaccine, and what they found was that it showed they altered the mRNA transcripts, and this is what it altered. So you have granulosa cells produce hormones. Okay. So they produce inhibin B, which is one of the hormones they looked at, and AMH. So what they found was inhibin B was significantly upregulated. So it was increased. So it produced more of that. Up, I think more than 200% it went up. And the significance of inhibin B, Naomi, is that it inhibits, that's where it gets its name from, the secretion of FSH, which is follicle stimulating hormone, which plays a crucial role in stimulating the growth and maturation of ovarian follicles found in the ovaries, which contain the eggs in women. So it inhibits FSH. Isn't that so shocking?
Isn't that birth control? I think that's what she's saying. It'll shut down the process. This is war on human reproduction. Among many, many other things. Many other things. So, all right. Well, there's another little tidbit for you. Okay, let's move to our human files. And sorry that was a bit technical, but it's in the record books. We just want to get a lot of this out there. So people who can go to the stories and the hours and read them and listen to them can understand what we're talking about or trying to. All right, July. Cancer from shedding.
What date?
Died suddenly. That's July 12.
Okay.
Amyloidosis swallowing. That's an odd one.
Oh, yeah. Well, you pick.
All right, let me do this because I think... Well, let's do this one real quick. Amyloidosis awareness. All right. Anyone experience eating problems? Swallowing food sometimes feel like the food stops right in the throat pipe. It feels like the food stops just before entering the stomach. The pain is often severe, and it may sometimes be prolonged in time. Sometimes it may extend for 15 to 20 minutes, but mostly it happens for a short period of time, a couple of minutes or so. Every attempt for swelling or swallowing some more will only add more pain to the situation, so you can't force it through if it's indeed stuck in the esophagus. This is... We have other stories we've read about difficulty swallowing. This is not unusual, and it's a part of the damaging to the neurology, I think, that's connected to the process of swallowing or retardation.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of people with gastrointestinal symptoms right now that seem to be coming on.
Right.
I don't know. There's right. quite a lot of them. A lot of heartburn, reflux, acid reflux. And it could be amyloidosis.
They think it's GERD.
GERD.
Yeah, go ahead.
And it could be, part of it is a vagus nerve issue. You need good parasympathetic tone to have a normal digestive function. And, if the muscles in the throat or the digestive tract are not working properly, you're not going to have good digestion. It could be a hiatal hernia where... the muscle of the diaphragm pushes up, and consequently, the contents of the stomach are forced up too. What else? There could be a lack of mucin in the stomach because a lot of people have, believe it or not, sulfur deficiency nowadays, and you need sulfur to make mucin and, you know, the protective layer of your gastrointestinal tract so it doesn't erode. Hydrochloric acid, the list is so long. And
it can be a very complicated. I think some can negatively impact other aspects that you're mentioning. And then you've got an almost insoluble mixture of cause and effect. It just sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah. And if there's amyloids that are now being deposited along the gastrointestinal tract, you're not going to have normal peristalsis. You know, the wave-like motion that pushes food along the digestive tract. So there's a lot of that going on now.
Got it. Okay.
And the other thing, too, is a lot of people are having gallbladder issues.
Lots of them. Yes.
Yeah.
And it goes into pancreatic issues, but gallbladder for sure.
Well, the liver is getting very congested, very congested. And that may be the lack of bile flow. People are having trouble manufacturing choline. You need choline to emulsify the bile. Cholesterol is an issue, sulfated cholesterol, so you're not going to be able to make your bile salts. It's just no end to the issues.
No, there's no end to problems. And imagine walking into the average GP doctor with any of these pathway problems. They're not going to figure it out. They're just not. They're going to run their traditional expensive AMA Rockefeller tests, and they're going to come up with, well, we don't know. The tests are all negative. So this is a truly and horrific weapon that has been turned loose on humankind.
Right.
Truly.
Yeah.
All right. Here's this cancer. You want to do the cancer? Did you find the cancer?
Yeah.
Cancer from shedding? Yeah, go ahead.
My previously very healthy, unvaxxed mother, who was 83, married a man in 2021 who was vaxxed and, in fact, got a shot 2 days before their wedding and a booster months later.
Oh.
Within three months, she was diagnosed with aggressive myeloma with amyloidosis and was in kidney and heart failure. At her first appointment, the oncologist asked her the first question, "Are you vaxxed?" When my mom said no, the oncologist said, "Thank God, my office is full of people who will be dead within months, and nothing I throw at them is working." My mom got treated and is still alive 19 months later. Oncologists know.
Oh, how interesting. Yeah, they won't talk about it, though. That's amazing that an oncologist would say that to her. So he must have trusted her, had respect in her, or had been frustrated out of his head. He didn't know what to do. That's shedding. Shedding. Okay. All right, where do we want to go? We can go down to...
Did we do this died suddenly? No, we didn't do that.
No. Okay. Go ahead.
I don't even know how to tell people. I just spoke to a friend who was very upset. She told me that her sister-in-law, 57, who was visiting from Texas, collapsed dead shortly after getting home from the airport, just today. She then told me that her firefighter cousin, who was very fit, went for a nap at home and didn't wake up. He was only 43. I hugged her and told her I was sorry and that it's so crazy how this is happening so much. She's like, yeah, and no one knows why. Sigh. How do you bring the you-know-what into the conversation in a kind way?
Good question. All right, here's another one. This is kind of a follow-on. This is a sequential died suddenly story. Ryan passed away suddenly in his sleep just 2 weeks after the mother of his children died from a brain infection. Ryan had an important message for those of us who are unvaxxed. Now, Ryan is dead, right? Just like his wife. Ryan had an important message for those of us who are unvaxxed and have refused to wear masks. He said, a huge shout out to the unvaxxed, anti-mask idiots who ruined it for the rest of us. Kitsap and Peace counties are stepping backwards. Don't let the ignorant guide you. The vaccine is not injecting the virus. The vaccine has no trace of COVID in it. Let me dumb it down for you. Info from my daughter's chem professor, also from every other legitimate study, simplest terms. The vax, Pfizer and Moderna, contains a protein that harmlessly mimics COVID and tricks your body into making antibodies. If you feel a little ill or tired after the injection, congratulations, that's your immune system at work. If you don't have a reaction, even bigger props for you. Your immune system is super strong. Simple as that. If you choose to ignore proven science and follow conspiracies, you will eventually take part in the reality of Darwinism. But hey, to each his own. All right. Well, I just say good luck. It's funny how these people stake out positions like that. I don't know.
You know, he lived and died by those words.
Certainly did. All right, July 5th, there's a died suddenly right there at the top. Oh, you want to go to unvaxxed COVID? Let's do that. That's next.
Oh, okay. All right.
Go.
All right. Advice, please. I am currently ill, and this flu has completely floored me. I do have underlying health issues. I've not partaken in any you-know-what. But obviously, it's near impossible to avoid being around others that have. I've lost most of my family members in the last 2 years. They all liked getting the you-know-what. Then the medical staff finished the job. I can't say more on that, as some are going through legal processes at the moment, but I'll be posting about it when I can.
So what she's saying is most of her family is dead.
Yeah.
I've lost most of my family members in the last 2 years. See, this is the big secret out there, how many people are dying. Go ahead.
I'm really not well. I'm a single mom to 2 children with additional needs. My mom on the phone wants to get me to the doctor's A&E, but no way, not after what they've done. I usually just carry on if ill, but I can barely get out of bed. I'm struggling to breathe. My head feels like it's in a vise. I'm dizzy even when I lay down. I'm dripping in sweat yet frozen. I have diarrhea, horrendous pain under my lower left rib. It started Sunday afternoon with a pain in my chest and feeling faint. I'm not after medical advice, just suggestions of natural products that can rapidly improve my immune system. So what can I order from Amazon in the UK that is available with Prime next day, which is going to help my immune system fight it?
Right.
I've ordered colloidal silver, 40 ppm, and some elderberry that should arrive this afternoon. No idea if I've got the best brands, but I tried to look at reviews, but my head is not with it. One of my children in the night thinks they're starting with it. Also, any recommendations as a preventative as if my other child gets it. He has a seriously compromised health status as it is.
This is not
well,
good.
I would say you got the virus.
Yes. If I might add real quickly again, in our opinion, the simplest and best 2 things you can do to improve your immune function and strengthen your overall physiology with nutrition is Allicin C and BioSuperfood. Those two products are so remarkably revolutionary and strong and effective that I really don't have adequate words for them. I could tell you I have received hundreds over the years of emails from people saying, thank you. Nothing else worked. No antibiotics worked. No nutritional vitamin and mineral supplements worked. BioSuperfood and Allicin C, I think, are the most important things that anyone can do, vaxxed or unvaxxed. And I would suggest 1 Allicin C capsule a day and then take whatever the BioSuperfood is in your weight or your particular physiological need. But those 2 things are gold, solid gold. All right. died suddenly. Our daughter's friend was watching TV last night, fell asleep, and never woke up. 28 years old. I'm not sure of her back status, but suspect the usual culprit. That's from North Carolina. Someone responds, "That is unreal. I'm 78 years old and have never seen anything like this. And our own crooked government did this to us." And boy, is she right.
Yeah.
All right. Forever virus. You want to jump into that one? See it?
Yep. New research. So if the virus is still in every organ and replicating, what things can combat that? Antivirals? And if the T cells are increased, what is known to decrease that? Things that suppress the immune system? But that would go against having a good immune system to get rid of the infection. And that's commenting on a recently released study, tissue-based T-cell activation and viral RNA persist for up to 2 years after SARS-CoV-2 infection.
There you go. Get that virus and you're tainted at least for 2 years.
And wow. A bunch of people chimed in on that. Yes, and I swear it's lasting longer than 2 years. I'm 4.7 years in now and still having all the long COVID issues.
Wow. Wow. No, these are unvaxxed people, apparently. They just had the virus.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Another one says, yes, how can we have viral symptoms years later if it totally goes away? I never bought that. Symptoms are from the low-grade virus, likely. Another one, exactly, 4.7 years here, too. Another one, same here, it's in my GI tract. And then she continues, I've been saying this since day one. It is stuck in me.
All right, I'd skip the next one. Go ahead.
Okay. Another one. I've said it once, I'll say it again. They put lots of money into treatments for HIV, and we aren't getting any of that money the way that HIV did back in the day. Until we do, there won't be any treatments for us, much less a cure.
No. Okay, the last string. This makes a lot of sense, that it would hide in our tissues and cause continual inflammation and immune system upregulation. T cells were always a suspect in why some practitioners have used HIV drugs to treat long COVID. I'm going on 4 years and 4 months, writes somebody. Another person says, I'm getting through a thorough immune system check right now, including my T cells. However, I have immunodeficiency and autoimmunity prior to COVID. Autoimmunity and immunodeficiency tend to roll together as both are caused by a dysregulated immune system. I have had low IgG and certain T cells were low. All I'd say is low T cells are not good and you don't want a low immune system in an overactive area. Finish up.
Similarities between HIV and SARS-CoV-2, my PCP reported. Another one, I still have COVID long-haul symptoms after 4 years and 7 months. Okay, someone's commenting on the study. 24 patients is a very small number to draw any kind of scientific conclusion.
Did you notice how we had about three or four people cite 4 years and 7 months? They must have been on the front line.
You know, that may have been the same person.
It could have been. Yeah, okay. Repeating herself. All right, very
yeah,
good.
Yeah, there were two total that I think were around four years, seven months.
All right, very good. We are out of time. That's our Monday program. We will be back Wednesday. Stay safe as much as you can, and don't laugh at masks and gloves. This stuff will go right through your skin. All right?
Yep.
Thank you. Good job, as always.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jeff. Good night, everyone.
We will be back with much more in just a few minutes. Hold on.